Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. You join us in the Soho editing suite of our sponsors Unbound, the website which brings authors and readers together to create something memorable. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And because we're all on our holidays in Wales or the British Library, but doing anything except sunning ourselves on a beach in Ibiza, we've got a slightly different show from the usual format. It might be difficult to imagine, but when we record a normal edition of Backlisted, we tend to overrun and we tend to occasionally digress.
Which means, obviously, that we've got lots of juicy, funny stories, which for reasons of space or timing or the poor taste of our editor fall on the cutting room floor.
Yes. However, as we're in a holiday mood, this is basically like the Simpsons clip show. It's like trying to, you know, do you remember, John, that time we talked about that book?
Do you remember that?
We thought we'd stitch some of those outtakes together and we'd give you the chance to hear some of the things that didn't make the cut first time around. And so we've got some of our guests, including Kit Duval and Rupert Thompson and Catherine Taylor. And of course, me. And John. So enjoy.
Without further ado. Kit Duval came onto the show to talk about William Maxwell's So Long, See You Tomorrow. She also spoke about the work she does in prisons, helping inmates engage with books.
And also, before we get onto Maxwell, there's one other thing I really, really like to get on the record on this podcast, which is I found totally fascinating. When we were doing the panel about what makes a classic, you were talking about your work with in prisons,
yes,
with getting prisoners to read and engage with books. Could you just say what the books or the book is that is most likely to engage a prisoner in a British jail? I found this fascinating.
Confederacy of Dunces.
No.
It is absolutely, if you meet a long-term prisoner, I have to say, and they can read, and of course that is a segment of the population, that's their book. I mean, you know, you can talk to prisoners, if they're readers, you won't get it out the library because it's just gone. They'll talk about that book over and over.
And the thing is, right, why I was so surprised and impressed about that is I found that quite a challenging read.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can't underestimate or patronise anybody, can you? You've got to...
I also think it's to do with the story about the book, about the writer, because he was, you know, he died young.
He's a loser.
He's a
poor
loser.
Old John Kennedy Toole.
Yeah, he wasn't discovered. He had this, you know, difficult life, and then there's this great book, and it's got that sort of quirky, can't swear, but, you know, that attitude. There's attitude in the book. And it's a big book. And if you're doing a long time in prison, you don't read the thin books. You want the chunky read. You're doing your time, and you can get through So Long, See You Tomorrow before light out, so you don't want that. Yeah. You want the chunky book that'll last you a while.
The thing that I love about that, I say this in Year of Reading Dangerously, is actually that many of the people, I find this hilarious when you said it, because I can add a category, right? Many of the people who love A Confederacy of Dunces are, to prisoners, we can add writers.
Yes.
Because there's something about the Ignatius J. Riley character, his belief that the rest of the world are idiots, who have failed to recognise his genius.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which is itself, but it's also like John Kennedy Toole burlesquing his own frustration about not being able to get published, right?
Totally.
So everyone in it is like exhilaratingly angry in that book, right? You know what I mean?
Yes.
Which I can imagine really transfers both writers and incarcerated people.
Absolutely.
You know?
I mean, but that is the best single literary fact I've heard in a long time.
So
really cheer me up. Because I love that novel. But I love the there is a theory about gout that it's all repressed rage. But that book is a sustained howl, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Of the most brilliant kind. And it's also, you know, there's no self-pity in it. Or in a way, the self-pity is transformed into something completely, completely different. It's the self-pity is so absolute that it becomes something else.
Yes.
So we were talking about, so that's a classic, Confederacy of Dunces. And we were talking about Maxwell, who we are going to talk about in a minute, as a classic. How did you get to the classics? Because I was really struck by what you were talking about, that you have read, like,
a lot.
Some big old books,
I
right?
I have. I was brought up in a house without books. With two classic publications, The Bible and The News of the World. And that was your reading material. Mm. My mother was an Irish Catholic turned Jehovah's Witness, and my dad was a bus driver, so he just read the News of the World, and my mother foisted the Bible on us. And I've read the Bible cover to cover at least three times.
Amazing.
I left school, left home when I was 15, and sex, drugs and rock and roll. Came to when I was about 21, 22, and thought, not smoking anymore, not taking any drugs, not drinking, what can I do? I know, I'll read. So I went to, I got some recommendations from my boss at the time, who's a lawyer, and I said, give me 10 books, just any 10 books. And he was an army man, so he gave me The Siege of Krishnapur, Three Men in a Boat, The Riddle of the Sands.
We've done Riddle of the Sands on this podcast.
He just gave me these 10 books, but in there, and I loved those books, no problem at all reading them, but in there was Madame Bovary.
Wow.
And in there was Thérèse Raquin, and lots of others. Amazing. And I was off. So I read those 10. And I went back and back and back to Dillon's, as it was then, and just bought the black penguin spines, just next black spine, till I felt I'd done that, a couple of hundred books later, probably.
That's so brilliant.
I discovered vintage, the pale blue-green modern classics.
Penguin modern classics.
20th century classics.
That's
or
right.
Modern classics.
So then it was Graham Greene. Oh, my God, I was in heaven. Arnold Bennett, Patrick Hamilton, and I just devoured those books.
Yeah.
And so by 97, because that was, if I started when I was 21, that was 1981. So by 97, I think I'd done quite a lot of reading. And I came across the Americans. I didn't get to the Americans because I was reading the French and the English. And then it was Henry James and blah, blah, blah. And I came across William Maxwell. And I'm amazed. I didn't know it was published in 1980. I would have said, from the reading of it, because I never opened the front, I just literally just went in cold. I would have said it was a 1940s, 50s book. Yeah. And it had that feel of it. And I was amazed, because when you asked me a forgotten classic, I wouldn't even say a book written in 1980, you know, qualified, because it's just not old enough, which is why I said that. And it's a mystery to me that I thought it was... Well, it's not a mystery. I understand.
I just want to commend you on the phrase Henry James and blah, blah, blah. because...
I didn't like Henry James at all.
You know, can I ask you... if you
Chewy, did, I think we'd have to say.
Have you carried on reading geographically? So have you gone through kind of like Russian authors? And then...
I did some Russia and Poland. I didn't do much of Scandinavian countries. And Italy passed me by. I didn't do Italy. I don't know why. Nor much of Spain. And haven't done a lot of South America. I've done bits, obviously, but I couldn't say France
the grand
really got
tour.
Me.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant. But also, I just thinking Alan Lane, you know, that was that sense of a,
absolutely.
Of a kind of a whole education that was accessible to, totally. To everybody. That whole
he accomplished that for me.
You know, and I think he did for millions of people as well. There was a wonderful thing I learned this week that in the week that it was published, the E.V. Rohr translation of the Odyssey was outselling. It was number one bestseller in the paperback. It was outselling everything else. It's just that there was that fantastic moment. I think it was a review of Pevsner that was saying there was this sort of post-war moment when actually the excitement that people could educate themselves and that classics were there and that there was it's such a great story.
Over the last 2 years, we've had some rather strange memes that keep popping up and off-the-cuff remarks that strike a chord with members of the backlisted family. Can I call you that? Well, I think I can. Anyway, one of these recurring themes, possibly because of the show we did on All the Devils Are Here by David Seabrook, is slightly dilapidated English seaside towns. Here's Andy explaining more.
Well, before I tell you what I've been reading this week, I need to update you on an important matter pertaining to our last podcast, our Patrick Hamilton extravaganza, Ultimate Backlisted TM.
With an additional pod for those
with
of you.
Yeah.
available. So good, we had to record more than we...
Available right now. So you might recall at the beginning of the last episode, I related a true story about seeing the actor Peter O'Toole launching his autobiography at an event at the Grand Hotel in Eastbourne 20 years ago, where he was asked
how do you write your books? And he replied, I use a pen and a piece of bloody paper. That was the end of the Q&A. Well, somebody was listening to that, and I had a message this week from Jonathan Main, who runs the brilliant independent bookshop in South London, bookseller Crow. And he sent me this message, which I'm going to read out verbatim because it really made me laugh. He said, just listen to Hamilton podcast. I too was at the O'Toole breakfast in Eastbourne and can confirm your story. He was smoking using a long cigarette holder and he was wearing a cape. My friend Stephen and I were staying at an old hotel on Eastbourne seafront. It had a rickety old lift with the old iron concertina gates that ran down the middle of it. The night before the breakfast, we had been out late and returning to the hotel, found the doors locked. It took us some time to raise the night porter, who appeared at the door in a panic, opened it, and ran back towards the lift, shouting, "She's gone! She's gone!" Whereupon, much to our pissed bemusement, the lift creaked downwards, the gates pulled back, and a recently deceased old woman was wheeled out on a gurney. Just thought you might appreciate, Jay. So thank you, Jonathan, for both confirming my story and one up.
That must have been a Booksellers Association conference, was
it? It was, yeah, it was. The BA conference.
I think I was at that conference as well, but sadly not at the Peter O'Toole launch.
Great idea for a book launch outfit for me, actually. I'm just thinking
a cape
and a long cigarette holder.
It's never amazing. A bad look, surely.
The critic and writer Catherine Taylor chose Vladimir Nabokov's, or Nabokov's, The Gift to talk about when she came on Backlisted a few months ago. There was so much in the book that we didn't manage to get on to the rich topic of the various letters Nabokov sent to agents, acquaintances and the like. Here's some of the stuff we had to leave out.
We must also stress Nabokov's humour. Mm. The humour in the book and the humour in everything Nabokov did is very, very present. And
proper wit.
I've got a letter here that he wrote to his New York agent, Altagracia de Janelli, in 1938, and she was attempting to place translation rights in Dar, The Gift. And Dmitry Nabokov describes her as the most energetic of a platoon of agents who homed in on VN after Laughter in the Dark. And this is in response, Nabokov wrote this letter in response to a reader's report, which the reader's report has been lost, but we have the letter. Brilliant. Okay, we have the letter. Here we go.
It's a Nabokov novel.
Dear Mr. Janelli, I am writing from a small mountain resort. I mean, that's pure Kinboat right there. Anyway, yeah. I am writing from a small mountain resort. On the whole, I rather liked N's description of The Gift, although it is very superficial. There is a lot more in my book, both for the connoisseur and the lay reader. Here are some objections. The Gift is thoroughly realistic, as it tells the story of a definite person, showing his physical existence and the development of his inner self. As he is an author, I naturally show his literary progress. Moreover, the whole story is threaded on my hero's love romance, with the underground work of fate revealed, an essential point which N has entirely missed. My style and methods have nothing, italics, in common with Joyce, though I greatly appreciate Ulysses. The novel is not, quotes, a crazy quilt of bits. It is a logical sequence of psychological events. The movements of stars may seem crazy to the simpleton, but wise men know that comets come back.
Whoa.
I don't understand why your reader should be, quotes, astonished at the, quotes, insertion of my hero's work's biography. The preceding chapters lead up to it, and as samples are given of all my hero's literary production, it would have been an impossible omission to leave his chief book out. Moreover, at this point, my hero's interpretation of Chernyshevsky's life, which incidentally took me 4 years to write, lifts my novel to a wider plane, lending it an epic note and, so to say, spreading my hero's individual butter over the bread of a whole epoch. In this work, Chernyshevsky's life, the defeat of Marxism and materialism is not only made evident, but it is rounded out by my hero's artistic triumph. As to the interest which The Gift might represent to the foreign American reader, I want to repeat that I know how to translate the book in such a way as to even avoid the necessity of footnotes. Human interest means Uncle Tom's Cabin to me, or Galsworthy's drivel, and makes me sick, seasick. Your faith in my work is of the greatest value to me, and I thank you warmly for your kind words. Yours very truly, Vladimir Nabokov. Isn't that wonderful?
I love him. There's another interview, just in case we got time, of him about the modern world, which, you know, it's just, he don't use phrases like modern world to Nabokov, he'll skewer you. So, but he comes, I love this. What I feel to be the real modern world is the world the artist creates, his own mirage, which becomes a new mirror world in Russian, by the very act of his shedding, as it were, the age he lives in. My mirage is produced in my private desert, an arid but ardent place with the sign "No caravans allowed" on the trunk of a lone pine palm.
Arid or ardent?
Oh yes, very good. Very
I know. Good. No caravans. Sorry, it's just too good. We could go.
So much more to say.
We could have. We've got so much more. We haven't got onto Poshlost at all, which is huge and important.
I didn't mention
it in my tweet. Huge and
what
important.
Do you want to say what it is? Go on. You got one. You got one line.
Go on. Fundamental concept in Nabokov, isn't it? The thing that he kind of writes, as it were, against.
Well, it's posh lust, but he refers to it as posh lust because he was a great punner, and it's about the phony and the vulgar, and
it's deeply kind of it's a very Russian concept.
It's one of those fairly untranslatable Russian words which are now we're now actually trying to translate for the sake of this program. But he accuses certain writers of actually. Falling victim to a certain banality of writing.
It's kind of critical banality as well. All of those kind of, you know, people who call things extraordinary and remarkable on podcasts, that kind of
awesome.
His whole life was lived against the reductive, wanting to be able to reduce things. He was about making things more complex and patterns and. He did not suffer the lazy reader.
As we have said on this podcast several times.
But I love the idea that he was looking, you know how you tell a butterfly, a new species of butterflies, to examine in a microscope, with a microscope, its genitalia. And that's what he was, you were talking about the amazing Nabokov's Butterflies book, the sketches. And all his novels were written in pencils. Mm.
And they also used index cards. Yeah. And in fact, Fyodor in the book, obviously, he uses index cards to write his book too. So
this is the bit that I put in the Year of Reading Dangerously from Lectures on Russian Literature. I may, if I am lucky, tap the deep pathos that pertains to all authentic art because of the breach between its eternal values and the sufferings of a muddled world. This world, indeed, can hardly be blamed for regarding literature as a luxury or a toy unless it can be used as an up-to-date guidebook.
As is usual on Backlisted, we're going to pause now for a moment to let an author from the Unbound stable tell you about their latest book. And this episode, it's Martin Fitzgerald, the author of Ruth and Martin's Album Club.
My name is Martin Fitzgerald, and I am the author of a book called Ruth and Martin's Album Club. And Ruth and Martin's Album Club is a book, formerly a blog, where we would make famous-ish people listen to albums that they'd never heard before. We started the project, I guess, with just some friends of mine and some journalists, and within sort of 18 months it became relatively popular, to the point where something that started out as a hobby for me, and it gets a little bit of a time suck in sort of evenings and weekends, ended up with us making, you know, J.K. Rowling listen to the first Violent Femmes album. We also had politicians. We had Tim Farron listening to N.W.A. We had a guy from the House of Lords listening to Public Enemy, and we were interested. It was a kind of antidote to 1001 albums you must listen to before you die. I've never really understood that sentiment. Ruth is a real person. I saw her about an hour ago, actually, and she's fine. There were lots of people that really didn't like the albums that they ended up listening to. But it was all done in an overall spirit of that doesn't really matter. There's no right or wrong here. So what I would hope that people got from the book is that just sense of fun, that it doesn't matter, because it doesn't. Every album that we did, I really liked. But I didn't mind when someone didn't like the album, as long as they made me enjoy them not liking it. So I want people to laugh at the book. I want people to be interested. A big part of the book is the stories of these artists. And what I've tried to do there is to not cover old ground and not do music journalism in inverted commas. I've tried to tell adventure stories because I think that all of these bands or singers, whether it's Elvis or Kendrick Lamar, if you tell them from the point of view of before those people made it, they are adventures and they're funny and strange things happen. And yes, you can talk about recording techniques and you can talk about the summer of love and you can talk about doing a complicated album on a four-track recorder. Or you can say, Paul McCartney was 24 when he did Sgt. Pepper. That's kind of mad, isn't it? Because that's now seen as vintage and progressive and classic. But he was like a kid. That's weird. I tried to tell the stories with a sort of lightness, and I think the guests had a sort of lightness to it too. So I would want people to read it and maybe check out the albums if they wanted to. That would be good. But mainly people just to read it and to smile and to realise that you can take music seriously by not being serious about music sometimes.
Ruth and Martin's Album Club by Martin Fitzgerald is available to order now from all good bookshops or from the Unbound website, unbound.com. Backlisted listeners can get a discount by putting in the code BACKOFF, that's BACKOFF, at checkout.
We've talked about books enough, now for some capitalism.
After that short interlude, we continue to rummage amongst the offcuts from the past editions, and we return once more, perhaps inevitably, to Eastbourne, where no doubt one day we shall all retire. It turns out that the novelist Rupert Thompson is a product of that town, as he explained when he came in to do the podcast.
So I may have just like...
So my mum lives in Bexhill.
Yeah.
And has lived in Bexhill for 27 years. She moved to Bexhill 27 years ago. Is the Curzon in Eastbourne, is that... It may not still be there. Cinema that's near the Arndale Centre?
It's on Seaside. It's sort of the east end of Eastbourne towards the Crumbles.
Yes, Crumbles indeed.
It's down that way.
Is that the name for people who live in Eastbourne?
this is becoming a regular Eastbourne podcast. Yeah. I told a story last time about seeing Peter O'Toole
in Eastbourne
at the Book Association conference.
Shabby English seaside towns.
There's a really famous one of the famous things I used to hear growing up was that Roger Moore lived in Eastbourne. And, you know, because there's one high-rise building in Eastbourne called South Cliff Tower or something. And he apparently had the penthouse in that.
Let's just assume that's true.
It's a lovely idea. Yeah. Lovely thought.
Pep up visits to home.
You can see
I can
him
feel
there.
Horrible psychogeography project kind of emerging, can't you? It's sort of a kind of benign... octogenarian version of All the Devils Are Here, set in Eastbourne. Well, it's not that nasty a place. People are mostly very nice here.
Mr. Bond, yeah. I assume, where you travel to towns where you've heard that Roger Moore might live as a way of exploring memory.
What is it about films? It's just because that All the Devils Are Here, the David Seabrook book, which we did at one of our favourite podcasts we've done last year, is all about. I mean, it was Charles Hawtrey plays a kind of sinister central role in that.
Who lived and very much died in a deal.
And then Whitstable, your own hometown, Peter
Indeed.
Cushing.
Indeed.
I mean, Peter Cushing lives in Whitstable. He buys vegetables on a bicycle. Was a song.
Was it?
Yeah, have you never heard?
How's that go?
Peter Cushing lives in Whitstable. He buys vegetables on a bicycle. On his bicycle.
It really comes alive.
I think it's called Peter Cushing Lives on. We used to have it on the QI website. I'll find it for you. Listeners.
Well. This episode is taking on unexpected new shapes and directions. Good.
Back in the mists of time, Andy and myself both worked for our sins in the bookselling trade. When William Fiennes came in recently to talk about Paula Fox, the conversation got onto the kind of events that we used to attend back in the last century.
I don't really go to these anymore, but in the 90s, I used to attend in my capacity as like a first a bookseller and then someone who worked at Waterstones head office and then a publisher
author dinners. Do they still have author dinners?
Well, we do, yeah. I mean, dinners where authors attend. Not quite in the same way, I think.
Yeah, in the 90s, what they used to do was they used to... Have they ever thrown one of these for you, William?
No, I think I missed the... There were a few lunches around.
Well, what they used to do was if an author had a book coming out, then the publisher would book a restaurant in the evening and they'd invite booksellers... And people from trade magazines and whatever from around London, and there'd be about 15 of you. There'd be you, and there'd be June from the Pan Bookshop, and there'd be somebody from Books Etc. and what have you. And there'd be this I now realise poor author. And I used to work for a great man called Dane Howell, who was the manager of the shop that I, Kensington High Street, Waterstones. And if he was invited to one of these dinners, he would often send one of us in his stead. If he couldn't go or didn't want to go.
He was just one of the great booksellers of all time.
And so I used to go to quite a few of these dinners. They weren't always great social events, was my, was my memory. But partly that was the fault of us, you know. That was partly our fault. I remember I went to, I won't say who this was, but I went to one author dinner for a quite a famous author where I'd had a very long day at the shop and I'd been out the night before. And they read extensively from their new... I fell asleep at the table. Yeah. And I have the copy of the book that they signed to me. And when I opened it, it said, you know, "Dear Andy, thank you for your close attention." Yeah. It's so humiliating. Yeah. I mean, so humiliating. But I know, it's terrible, isn't it? It's terrible. I keep it as a reminder, you know, that you should... behave yourself properly. I once went to a dinner somewhere in Chelsea. I can't even remember where this was. It was for the publication of Sir Roy Strong's diaries, and it was when I was at head office, and so it was a dinner for about it was a, like a dozen people tops, and I really like Sir Roy Strong. He is a very intelligent and entertaining,
brilliant storyteller.
And he went round the table. He did a thing after dinner. He went round the table and he said to each person, "And who are you? And where do you work? And what have you got?" He got to me and he said, "And who do we have here? This young gentleman who looks like a cross between Keats and the young Mick Jagger." Clearly, this was some time ago. Now that I look like, you know, Mick Jagger as he looks now and Keats as he looks now. But that was really, really fun. That was really, really nice. That was for his diaries from the 60s to the late 80s. Yeah. I'm waiting for the publication of his diaries for the period in question to see if there's a mention of Keats, Mick Jagger. But I also, in 1997, I sat next to the Doctor Who actor Tom Baker,
right,
at a Waterstones managers conference. And it was to tie in with the publication of his memoir, "Who on Earth is Tom Baker?" And now Tom Baker, my absolute childhood hero as Doctor Who. And you know, there are many, many good Tom Baker stories. Tom very much then, and presumably still does, like to drink. And so I sat next to Tom... throughout the dinner, we ate and we drank, and it was a great highlight of my life, let alone career. Yeah. And towards the end of the meal, Tom Baker turned to me and he said, "You're a very good-looking boy." I said, "Thanks very much, Tom." "Yes, you're a very good-looking boy." And then he looked at me and he said, "But what will you do when your looks fade?" And I should have said, you know, appear regularly in a non-visual medium.
As well as chatting about books, writing, writers, and occasionally when we've finished, we retire to the pub and chat about other stuff. As this is a kind of summer special, we'll leave you with a cautionary tale of why you should always wear footwear when swimming in the southern seas. We hope you enjoy the show. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with a more regular edition. Goodbye.
So this is, this right up there with bad holiday stories, bad holidays I've lived through. It was actually a wonderful place to be. I was on the island of Rarotonga in the Cook Islands with my family. And I was finishing, as traditionally I was doing on holidays, was finishing a book, which was the first draft of the second book of General Ignorance, the QI book. So I'd been spent basically all week researching. Amazingly, there was quite good internet out there, so researching stuff and writing up these ridiculous questions that you think you know the answers to but don't.
Yeah.
The last day I'd sent it off, and I was able to tell the boys that finally I was going to be able to go out snorkeling with them. And having been kind of absolutely on top of them all week long, telling them to wear reef shoes, I thought I'd go and have a snorkel. I went and had a snorkel. We had a great time. I had a sort of morning ritual. I always used to like to go and find a blue starfish. That's why there's a blue starfish on my phone.
Oh, yeah.
Incredibly beautiful things. And sort of weird blue things are odd in nature. Yeah. Found a blue starfish and then just landed gently on the sea floor, felt a little prick, and then swam back casually. And the prick got worse and worse. And by the time I'd actually got back, and it was actually really quite sore. My brother noticed that. He said, "You're limping." Well, I said, "Oh, I don't know, I stood on something." And he said, "Well, are you sure you didn't stand on something really dangerous?" I said, "Oh, what's the chances of that? I've only been in the water for 20 minutes. Anyway, to cut a long story short, about half an hour later, I was in severe agony and starting to sweat and feeling like I was about to pass out. So we drove to the hospital. There's one hospital in the... in the main drag of Rarotonga, and got there. And by this stage, I was really starting to panic, because it occurred to me that I probably had stood on something. And the thing that you all dread to stand on is the stonefish, the legendary
stonefish.
Yeah. Right. So I go, and being very English, I go up to the counter and say, "I appear to have stood on something in the reef." And the woman would have said, it was very relaxed. She said, "Oh, go on, sit down. Don't be worrying. You'll be fine." And Rachel's saying, "I don't think he's going to be fine. He doesn't look fine to me." And she said, "Well," she said, "he stood on a stonefish."
What kind of pain?
The pain is a very, very intense pain in the puncture wound that you can feel, but it gets worse and worse and worse. Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly sharp, and I mean, you do start to. I mean, I was starting to really find it difficult to remain conscious. Okay. Partly shock, I suspect. So not nice. None of this was good. Okay. Anyway, she says, "I'll go and see if I can find the doctor." Rachel said, "The doctor? Isn't this a hospital?" Anyway, I was by this stage. The only thing I could do, I was sort of hopping around, trying to, and I saw a guy in scrubs, and he said, "Oh no, it's all right. The doctor will be through." So I saw the doctor. The doctor looked at my foot. He listened to the story, and he said, "Ah," he said, "Yeah." He said, "I've got some good news and some bad news." I said, "Well, what's the good news?" He said, "You're not going to die. It's only one spine." He said, "We had a kid last year, three spines, had to chop his foot off." I said, "Okay, that's good." I said, "What's the bad news?" He said, "You see, you know what to do with a stonefish. You've got to get hot water on it, kills the toxin." But he said, I said, "Yeah, it was about an hour ago." And he said, "Yeah, I'm going to have to inject it with an anti-necrotic." And I said, "You know what that is?" I said, "Well, I know what anti means and I know what necros means." He said, "Yeah, you see, the toxin kills the skin, so I have to stop that." So I said, "Fine." I said, "Well, where do you have to inject it?" "In the puncture wound." So I'm on the thing with the guy. I mean, my brother had to hold me down, and it was like a horse syringe, horse tranquilizer. It was a massive bloody thing. Incredibly painful. And then he said, "You're fine. I'll give you some conine. Go and have a beer. Enjoy your last night on the island." So I did. I sort of sat there with my foot in a bucket, kind of in a lovely opiate haze, drinking beer. Unfortunately, the next day on the plane on the way back, I noticed that my leg had started to swell. And by the time we arrived in Queenstown in New Zealand, where we were supposed to be going skiing, I mean, it was like massive, my leg had... And I got off the plane. I hadn't seen my daughter for 2 years. And the first thing we said is, "We've got to go to the doctor." So what's wrong with Dad? He stood on a stonefish and it's gone wrong. So anyway, it turned out that I had the New Zealand, very brusque New Zealand doctor said, stonefish. She said, "We don't get many tropical fish injuries up here in the mountains. It's normally people breaking their legs skiing." She said, "Yeah, but that's cellulitis." I said, "That's what?" Well, she said, "What did you do after the doctor had died?" And I said, "Put my bucket of water." "Bucket of water? A bucket of water? I mean, what, full of germs? You've got the wound's infected." And she got a biro and she drew a line around my thigh. And I said, "What are you doing that for?" She said, "Well, that's where the infection's got to." And I said, well, what happens? She said, well, if it gets to your heart, you die.
Oh.
I said, well, is it likely to? Well, that's, I'm about to give you a bloody large dose of antibiotics to stop it. So another bloody great syringe comes out, pumps that in. And then she said, right, now you're not allowed to drink, you're not allowed to... And I said, what antibiotic was that? I'd just written a question for QI about, you know, can you drink and have antibiotics? It turns out you can drink with almost all. There's two antibiotics of the 100 that are available that react badly with alcohol. So I vouchsafed this information. Ah, she said, smart ass. Right. Okay, yes, you can. I said, well, look, I've come here to drink wine with my best friend. I haven't seen him for 10 years. It's Central Otago Pinot Noirs. I want to drink them. She said, all right. She said, you can have a drink as long as you keep your foot above your heart. And if you can find a bar in Queenstown that will serve you, good luck to you. Yeah. Anyway, cut to about an hour later, and there I was with my foot on a bar. And I managed to arrange a stool with a large glass of Pinot. Everybody who came into the bar was saying, Stonefish! The blokes were doing a Stonefish! Anyway, the coda to the story is, on the way back, we stopped in Hong Kong, and I, by this stage, I'd researched Stonefish to death, and I discovered that there were Hong Kongs that specialised in Stonefish restaurants. In Hong Kong that specialised in stonefish. So we found one, and I got to choose my stonefish, that little bastard at the back, and they served it stonefish three-way, which was brilliant. We managed to consume everything, the bones and everything. It was really satisfying. But yeah, I mean, just wear reef shoes if you find yourself in tropical soup. If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole two extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.